And our next speaker is, are you the next one?
Yes, I am.
Come and introduce yourself and then I'll stick to the time giving you the present.
Thank you, Danny. My name is Ashkan Maoz. I've been for many years on the Law Faculty of Tel Aviv University, and recently I'm the founding dean of the new established Teres Institute Law School. The name Teres may seem familiar to you and you are not known. I'll be speaking about the Jewish perspectives of religious freedom. Actually, religion and religious freedom don't go hand in hand. And if you are convinced that truth lies with you, and obviously all religions are certain of that, why should you tolerate and more so accept, not to mention respect, teachings that you know to be false? The term freedom of religion is a new one. It doesn't appear in all writings. It certainly doesn't appear in Judaic classical teachings. And it may convey two meanings. One is, I would say, outward and inward. Outward meaning the freedom of the other to adhere to a different religion, and inward the freedom of conflicting streams within your own religion, not to mention the non-religious members of your community. It would be correct to say, I guess, in a nutshell, that Judaism is a non-missionary religion outward, but not so inward. I will divide my talk into in the same direction, outward and inward. Inward depends on time. When we speak about the Jewish attitude towards other religions, I believe we should split it into three time periods. Obviously, past, present, and future. The past starts with the flood, when the survivors of the flood were given the seven Noahide commandments, which are obligatory upon all mankind. And as Maimonides put it, whoever among the nations fulfills the seven commandments to serve God belongs to the righteous among the nations and has a share in the world to come. When I speak about the second period, you'll be interested to know that I have to fulfill 613 commandments in order to be rewarded as any other for fulfilling seven commandments. Mind me of that joke. Well, thank you for choosing us. Perhaps you choose another nation. Arguably, this statement infers that the Noahide commandments are optional, as only those who choose to fulfill them will be rewarded. But this is not the attitude. Every human being is bound by the seven commandments. One more thing to say is that Maimonides insists on the fact that you will be rewarded for fulfilling the seven commandments of Noah only if you do so because God so ordered. If you do so out of your own intelligence, then he says you are a wise person, but that's not fulfilling God's commandments. Second stage starts with this, with the appearance of the Jewish people and the revelation of Mount Sinai, but I will skip to the third phase, the last days. We all know the prophecy of Micha, who tells us that in the last days the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as chief among mountains, It will be raised above all hills, and peoples will stream to it. Many nations will come and say, Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways, so that we may walk in his paths. The law will go out from Zion, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. There's much debate in Judaic sources as to which law will go out of Zion and what will be the paths that the peoples will follow. Are they verbally the Torah of Israel, given to the children of Israel, or is it the ultimate word of the Lord that may be referred to as scriptural truth? I would like to attack your attention, however, to the fifth verse in Micah's prophecy. All the nations may walk in the name of their gods. We will walk in the name of the Lord our God forever and ever. Obviously, Micah was not referring to the end of the days, because in the end of the days, we will all walk in one tent. He actually described the present situation. And I guess this phrase may be understood as laying down the ground for contemporary attitude towards what may be coined in present terminology as freedom of religion for the non-Jews. For until the last days, it is only the children of Israel that have spoken in the name of the Lord, meaning the Torah that he gave us, while all other nations are free to walk in the name of their gods. Until then, the Lord seems to entertain a dual character. He's the God of Israel, yet at the same time, he's the Lord of universe. Maimonides makes an interesting observation. He notes that Moses bequeathed the Torah and commandments to Israel only, and to whomever wishes to proselyte from the other nations. But whoever does not wish, we do not coerce him to accept Torah and commandments. He continues and notes that Moses, our master, ordered in the name of the Lord to enforce all creatures on earth to accept all the commandments that were ordered to Noah, and whoever does not accept them will be put to death. We may find, both in the Bible and in Judaic classic teachings, harsh statements regarding idolatry, binding paganism with moral corruption. It is essential to note in this context that according to the sages, this does not apply to monotheistic faiths. In this regard, a distinction was drawn in the past between Islam and Christianity. Maimonides and his disciples, while regarding Islam as pure monotheism, had a problem with Christian Trinity. On the other hand, sages that lived in Christian countries ruled, and I quote, though they utter the name of an alien divinity, their intention is to the creator of heaven and earth. Nowadays, there is full agreement that the rules regarding adulterous religions apply to neither Muslims nor Christians. But this is a place to say that Judaism is much closer to Muslims, which make the situation in the Middle East even more tragic. Rabbi Menachem Amiri regarded both Muslims and Christians, and I quote, nations bound by the way of religion, different from the pagan societies of ancient times that were not restricted by religious laws and norms. Thus both Christians and Muslims were regarded as, and I quote again, assemblies for the sake of heaven, designed to endure. Their intentions are for the sake of heaven, and the reward will not be withheld. Rabbi Joseph Albo, who is even admitted the existence, and this is a far-reaching statement, the existence of two divine Torahs at the same time for different nations. Christianity and Islam were not only regarded as legitimate religions, but were even praised for removing the idols and subordinating their nations to the Noahide laws, thus giving them moral attributes far beyond what was demanded of them by the Torah of Moses. if I have a few minutes, and I guess I do have.
Yes, you have another 12 minutes.
Ah, good. So I'll move to what I call the inward freedom of religion. Here, leniency towards deviant opinions, heresy, whatever, is even more problematic when you deal with your own people. For the children of Israel are part of the covenant with God at Mount Sinai. Children of Israel are bound by the covenant and are not free to deviate from the paths of the Torah. The covenant, as we know, was made with all the children of Israel, and we are told in the Talmud that the covenant was made with their children and their children's children till the end of the days. A further relevant component is the sense of mutual solidarity between Judaism, the sense that all Israelites are guarantors to each other. Therefore, it is the duty of each and every Jew not only to abide by halakha, which is the religious law, but also to make sure that their fellow Jew abides by it. It is the behavior of each and every Jew that may influence the revelation of eternal salvation. It is therefore that Judaism cannot sanction freedom of religion from within. This is, however, an oversimplistic statement of the halakha. Torah tells us that a matter too hard for to judge should be brought before the Levitical priests or the magistrate in charge at the time, and one must act, and I quote, in accordance with the instructions given to you and the ruling handed down to you, and must not deviate from them. This function was carried out by the great Sanhedrin, who served as the final authority on Jewish law, and any scholar who went against his decisions was regarded a rebellious elder and theoretically liable to capital punishment. However, the scholar does not become a rebellious elder by merely teaching his opposite opinion, but only if he instructs others to act in accordance with his minority dissident opinion. We are told in the Talmud of one of the leading sages who was offered the position of president of the Sanhedrin if he resigns his differing opinions from that of the majority of the sages. He rejected the offer, stating that he would rather be called a fool by not accepting such a position and not become an evil person by giving up the truth as he saw it. The same goes for the crime which is stated in Jewish sources, discovering new faces of Torah not in accordance with halakha. Against this crime does not include one who merely teaches a conclusion different than that of the sages. The Talmud is full with conflicting opinions, and both majority and minority opinions are regarded to be, and I quote, words of the living God. The Talmud, moreover, does not regard the ruling opinion of the majority as more right than that of the minority. We are even told that the conflicting opinion is reported, since in the future it may become the decisive one. The right to deviate is not restricted to the academic sphere. There is no hope in Jewish religion, as all of you I guess know. Even the Institute of Chief Rabbi, which we are so familiar with, is the most non-Jewish institute that exists. It was actually imposed on the Jewish communities in the diaspora by the rulers who wanted to speak to one representative rather to all the rabbis. Since the abolition of the Sanhedrin, Judaism lacks a central institute that will decide controversial issues. The rule is rather that each and every Jew may choose his own rabbi and abide by his rulings. The Talmud says, make your own rabbi and buy or purchase your friend. There is a lot of debate about why do you have to purchase a friend and make a rabbi. That's out of question now. Referring to this phenomenon, Justice Menachem Elon of the Supreme Court of Israel, an Orthodox Jew, wrote, "It is well known that Jewish thought over the ages, including the halachic system, is full of varying perceptions and conflicting approaches. Certainly it goes without saying that these approaches and perceptions taken together have contributed to the deepening and enriching of Jewish thought. Pluralism," he says, "is not a negative phenomenon or a defect. It is of the essence of the halakha." And he quotes the multiplicity of views and approaches tend moreover to create harmony and uniformity through diversity. He quotes the last codifier of Jewish law, Rabbi Epstein, and I conclude with that. "Every dispute among the sages in pursuit of true understanding constitutes the world of the living God, and each has a place in the halakha. That is indeed the glory of our holy and immaculate Torah. The whole Torah is called His song, and it is the glory of the song that its different sounds are various but harmonious." Thank you.
I was just wondering if you would continue to expound on your interpretation of Isaiah and the word of the Lord and following the law. I was interested in what you said, but I wanted to hear a little more about
it. You mean about what will be the Torah in the end of the days?
Yeah.
What I mentioned is, we have to wait and see what will be there, but what I meant to say, there are two possibilities. Either all nations will adopt the Jewish religion at the end of the days, which is the Torah that will come out of Zion, or God will give a new religion, which will be the ultimate word of the Lord, meaning that the Jewish religion itself is not the final word. It is the final word for the Jews until the end of the days. And then the Lord will give us His, I would say, His final or absolute truth. But for that, it's an opinion that you can find in the sages.